Local filmmaker Kevin Wilmot has a new movie called BlacKkKlansman. It's based on the true story of a black undercover cop named Ron Stallworth, who infiltrated a Colorado chapter of the Ku Klux Klan.
Hello, this is Ron Stallworth calling.
Well, who am I speaking with?
This is David Duke.
Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. That David Duke?
Last time I checked. What can I do you for?
Well, since you asked, I hate blacks. I hate Jews, Mexicans and Irish, Italians and Chinese. But my mouth to God's ears, I really hate those black rats. And anyone else, really, that doesn't have pure white Aryan blood running through their veins.
So that's a monologue that'll get your attention at 10 in the morning. What you cannot ignore when you're watching this and not just listening is that the actor delivering those lines is black, and he's talking with colleagues at the police department, slowly turning around in their chairs and staring in utter confusion, not yet knowing what he's up to. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with Kevin Wilmot, who just returned from the Cannes Film Festival with that movie, BlacKkKlansman, which was awarded the Grand Prix, a major distinction. Kevin Wilmot, good morning.
Good morning. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. So I should say right off the bat, this was a collaboration between you and Spike Lee.
Yes, yes. I've been working a lot with Spike in the last few years, and we wrote it together.
So the plot of BlacKkKlansman sounds like some kind of absurdist farce. It actually kind of reminds me of the Dave Chappelle skit about the BlacKkKlansman who doesn't know he's black, but it's based on a true story.
Yeah. I mean, it's, some things you just can't make up, right? Ron Stallworth was the first black policeman in Colorado Springs in the 70s. And he was like the Jackie Robinson of their police force, you know. And so it was a little weird, the environment he kind of walked into. And then on top of it, they put him in charge of monitoring all the radical groups that were in the area. And, you know, this is 70, so there's a lot of radical groups, right? I mean, you know, left wing, right wing, the whole bit. And
yeah, he might have been able to go incognito in some crowds more easily than others.
Yes. Yeah. And you see some of that in the film. So he's at his desk at the police station and he's looking in the newspaper and he sees an ad in the local newspaper in Colorado Springs for the Klans. Like, please, you know, we're looking for members, you know, please join us and call this number. So he just he's young, he's very young, and he, you know, he's a rookie the whole bit. And so he just calls the number and they fall in love with him.
And so there are actually two Ron Stallworths in the movie, and I guess like in real life. There's the real Ron Stallworth, played by John David Washington. He is Denzel Washington's son. And then there's the white guy who acts kind of like his stand-in when he has to meet the other Klansmen in person.
Yes, yes. And Adam Driver plays that part. And
I love Adam Driver.
Yeah, he's really great. He's really great in this film, too. Yeah, you know, the whole concept of how there were two Ron Stallworths was a lot of fun to play with. You know, and the fact that, you know, that really did happen is even, you know, more crazy.
So the real Ron Stallworth in real life wrote a book about his experiences, and then you kind of turned the book into a movie. But how did you get involved in that project? Because it existed before you came on board.
Right, right. There had been a couple other writers before Spike and I got involved, and they approached Spike to direct the film. Jordan Peele did. This is right after Get Out. And we met with Jordan Peele, and he really wanted Spike to direct it, and he wanted us to rewrite it. And the only note he gave us was just, you know, make it funny.
So, I mean, it is funny, but there's a lot that it addresses that is not funny. And that's true of most really good comedies,
yes,
but
indeed.
It's still a fine line to walk.
No doubt about it. And, you know, the thing I like to talk about, at least I kind of tell my students, is that I kind of believe it like this, is that you really, you know, when you deal with this kind of material, which is kind of in a way it's satire in a way. But in this case, it's true. You know, you don't try to be funny. I mean, you just approach it seriously and dramatically and honestly. And in the context of that, you expose the absurdity. You expose what's funny and crazy and insane about the whole ridiculous, you know, experience of this, of these kind of hate groups and so forth. And so the humor kind of just comes to the surface, in essence, I think, on its own.
Yeah, like the story has the humor in it, so you don't need to, like, ham it up or...
Exactly. I mean, there are no jokes. It's just funny because when you're on the phone talking to the Klan and you're black and they love you and you're having to say all this hateful stuff, it's just crazy and funny and absurd in that sense.
What is really interesting to you about the actual story the movie is telling?
Well, I think, you know, we do several kind of things with the context of the story. One is, you know, when you're black and you have to kind of, you're a policeman, and I think this really resonates today in a lot of ways. You're often put in these situations where you have to kind of do things that you sometimes feel like you're maybe hurting the black community, you know? And we even, it's an element of the film that we address the kind of the blue wall of silence, you know, which is police kind of misbehavior and police abuse and so forth. And so there's that. And then then the other side of the story with the Adam Driver character is that, you know, I think even, you know, white people in various ways, in this case, Adam Driver's character is Jewish. You know, when you look white, you don't have to deal with race unless you kind of choose to. And in this case, his character, because he's Jewish, but he's never really dealt with the fact that he's Jewish. He's never had to really kind of answer questions about it. And all his friends, you know, as a kid, think he's just white. You know, he has to confront the fact that he's Jewish.
When he's
infiltrating the KKK, because they're constantly doing anti-Semitic stuff, and so you know, in that sense, he's passing in a way, and so I think there are a lot of people in American life, in various ways, not just black folks, but in all kinds of different ways, that are passing in various ways.
You know, I really kind of I love the trailer, which is all I've had the opportunity to see so far. I cannot wait to see the movie. But, you know, I really hemmed and hawed about whether to play that clip from the trailer, the one we played earlier in the show. And I wonder if my questions about it are things you kind of wrestle with, too. I mean, in the context of the story and the movie, that hateful screed delivered by John David Washington is just clearly a joke, and the joke is on David Duke. But the language he uses is stuff you kind of hate to even put out there because you don't know who's listening, what they'll do with it.
Right. Well, I think one of the things we have to come to terms with in American life is that there are a lot of racist people in the country, and they use that language all the time. They don't use it in front of us, but they use it behind the scenes, and they use it privately with their friends. And that's just a reality. One of the reasons I know that is that my kids are biracial, and some of my kids look white. And so they'll be in situations where people will think they're white, and they'll just start throwing the N-word out. And so they have to then correct them and say, oh, by the way, I'm black and I don't like you saying that. And so, you know, I experienced this when I was a kid. My kids now experience it. It's just a fact of American life that we're a racist country, and we elected a racist president, and he's racist every day, and we don't say anything about it. And we just have to tolerate it. And so, you know, we have to kind of accept that fact. And I think the sooner we accept it, the sooner these kind of folks will kind of go away.
So does sort of acknowledging and owning racism mean, like, kind of putting it out there?
We have to have an honest discussion about it. And certainly when you're talking about the Klan or neo-Nazis, the alt-right, any of these hate groups, they kill people. They just kill people sometimes. They kill people all the time in America. I mean, they're the biggest terrorist group in the country. And we are far more, you know, dangerous and scary than the so-called other terrorists that we're supposed to always be worried about. And so we have to be really honest about that. And we have to, you know, we have to be willing to be uncomfortable in those conversations. And we have to be willing to kind of go to those places where you know, that discomfort is just unfortunately a part of the reality.
Does looking at it through the lens of a true story that took place in 1978 put it in a new light for you?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the challenge to the filmmaker is always, you know, how do we make it entertaining? And, you know, one of the things that Spike said that he wanted it to really resonate to today. He didn't want it to be a period piece. And unfortunately, that wasn't hard to do. And so there's all these connections to today. And when I was in college, for instance, I was president of the student body at Marymount College in Salina, Kansas. And I got a letter from David Duke when I was president of and it was, he was, his organization at that time was the NAAWP, National Association for the Advancement of White People. And at that time, he was now leaving the Klan, the hooded, sheeted Klan, and was becoming a politician. And that is now what is happening in American life. I mean, he started it back in the 70s when I was in school, but he now, you know, and others like him have made that transition from the Klan of the sheets and all of those things to these talking points that are ultimately Klan talking points. Now they've become kind of Republican Party talking points in a lot of ways. And they have now become just accepted politicians. And now we even have one in the White House.
When you think about David Duke and you know what we know about how his story has progressed since the story that you're telling in this movie, Black Klansman, how did that influence how you had Topher Grace play this character, how you wrote the character?
Yeah, Topher Grace is really great, by the way. He really nailed David Duke, and you know it was
a young David Duke.
And there, I talked to him quite a bit on the setup. I wasn't there on the set a lot, but I got to have some conversations with him about it. And there's a certain kind of distant, kind of disturbed quality about him, and I think that's. I think that's kind of inherent in those type of people, that they're emotionally distant, that they think they're, you know, by the way, David Duke's family, his father went to KU, and he, you know, he would say things like this woman that was their black maid in their house, that how much he loved her. And there's all the, and how they don't, he doesn't think he's a racist. I mean, that's the kind of things they say. And so there's always these weird kind of beliefs that these folks have that, you have to find a way to take those things and then, you know, write them and present them back to the audience in a manner that, you know, hopefully we can gain some understanding from.
What was it like for you to show Black Klansman, not in America, but at the Cannes Film Festival in France with an international audience?
Wow, it was mind blowing, I have to say. I mean, you know, you're driving down the street in this big motorcade, and then you get out and there's the red carpet and the paparazzi and, you know, the whole shtick, and the theater itself is just, you know, this palace. And then, you know, there's all these celebrities all around you, but they really ate up the movie. I mean, they really, really, really got it. I mean, they were laughing and applauding throughout the film.
Was there a moment that people reacted to, or I guess responded to, especially strongly, that was either heartening or surprising for you?
You know, I mean, when you write something, you're always kind of, when you write the line, you're always hoping, well, this will be the response, right? You kind of, you know, you almost want to say and hold for the laugh, you know, but you
yeah,
don't know.
Don't put a crucial following line too fast, because they're going to be laughing.
They're going to be laughing. Yeah. That's what you hope, right? You don't always get that, but that's what you always hope. And that was really throughout the entire film. I mean, they really reacted the way you hoped that they would react.
You know, the movie will be in theaters here pretty soon. But, you know, what are some questions or conversations you anticipate coming up a lot once people in the United States, the general public, start seeing it?
Well, you know, I think one of the reasons that they loved it so much in France was they know the danger of our president, and they know the danger that he presents to the world. And they've been seeing him say those racist, horrible things. And and they've been waiting for us to respond to it. And the movie kind of does that in various ways. And I think that's one of the things that people will find hip and funny and really kind of cool. But I think that, you know, it's going to challenge us here at home and in a very entertaining way. I mean, you know, it's not a, you know, I mean, you don't have to preach when it's already there, unfortunately. And so I think the audience will really enjoy the film, but it's going to remind us of where we live.
Did it challenge you? I mean, did you have any moments of insight or revelation as you were making the movie?
Well, I think I've thought a lot here recently about how people think that any time you talk about race, that you're being racist, that they believe that if you don't talk about race, that somehow ends racism, that, you know, and these are those kind of, you know, middle-class folks that don't have to deal with race on a regular basis. And you see them comment on things online and things like that. And I've thought a lot about them here recently that they believe that if you just, you know, stop talking about race, stop making movies about race, stop doing these kind of things. And that's why they think Obama was such a racist president, because his blackness was always there and it made them have to think about race every day. And if his blackness wasn't there, wouldn't have to have that unfortunate conversation.
Well, Kevin Wilmot, we are going to have to catch up with you more when Black Klansman comes out. Thanks for being here today.
Oh, great to be here. Thank you.
Kevin Wilmot's new movie in collaboration with Spike Lee is Black Klansman, starring John David Washington, and it won the Grand Prix at the Cannes Film Festival. Up next, an older movie, Robert Altman's Kansas City. Did the filming of that movie change the way we see our history here? I'm Gina Kaufman. That's coming up.
Every story has two sides.
I know everything there is to know about what's going on.
In Kansas City. Directed by Robert Altman.
That's kind of a blast from the past, right? It's the trailer from Robert Altman's Kansas City. That's the movie that put a spotlight on the story of jazz and gangsters in the 1930s, but it was filmed in the 1990s. Union Station hadn't been renovated. It was sitting empty. 18th and Vine wasn't getting the kind of citywide love you might imagine either. So when Robert Altman decided those places and the stories they told were not just cool, but worthy of a movie, that was exciting for people, even though in the end, it wasn't a box office hit. As Altman's son heads to town for a screening of the movie, we're looking at what it meant to us then and what it means to us now. Let's start with KCUR's Chuck Haddix, who is a consultant on the film. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, Gina. Good to be here with you.
Good to have you. What kinds of things were people talking about in the community when word started getting out that Robert Altman was making a movie about Kansas City jazz in the Pendergast era?
Well, there was quite a buzz, you know, at that time when it came to town. And, you know, they're telling the story of Kansas City, and they're telling the story of two Kansas cities, 18th and Vine, and of course downtown, and they're telling the story of political corruption and jazz. I mean, it has all the elements, exciting elements, to make a great movie.
But did Kansas City relate to those pieces of its history differently then than it does now, in your view?
Yeah, I think so. I think that we have a lot more appreciative of our history now than we were back then. And 18th and Vine, you know, was pretty much deserted. There wasn't much going on down there at all. And so this brought Kansas City jazz to the national forefront and raised it in our consciousness. You know, people in Johnson County may not know about Kansas City jazz. They certainly did after Robert Altman's film.
There was some hope from the beginning that this would spark more interest in places like Union Station and 18th and Vine and have some sort of like concrete influence on how we treat those places. Do you think it did that?
I think it did. It drew, how shall I put this? At that time, Union Station had large puddles of water in it. It was leaking, and it had fallen into disrepair. And I think that the fact that they went in, cleaned it up, and showed what it could be, Same with 18th and Vine. They put facades on the buildings, the vacant buildings on Vine Street between 18th and 19th, and basically recreated what 18th and Vine really looked like. And I think that gave us the possibilities of these landmarks in our history.
Do I understand correctly that some of those facades are still what we have there?
No, they've been taken down over the years and fallen down. I was contacted initially by Frank Barheit, who co-wrote it with Robert Altman, and he also was a Kansas City native. This is territory they knew well. And I think they were a little too close to it because a lot of people were kind of confused about what's the meaning here of Pendergast. You know, there's a lot of inside stuff in there that someone from another city would not necessarily catch.
Well, we're going to get back to that in just a minute, and I want to talk to you a lot about the music. But first, let's turn to Susan M. Schwiller. She worked on the set for the movie, and she went inside Union Station before the renovations as part of that work. Hi, Susan.
Hi there.
So you were coming here from out of town to work on this movie about Kansas City jazz, old-timey gangsters, stuff like that. What did you know about all of that before you got here?
I didn't know a thing. I had heard of St. Valentine's Day Massacre, but I had no idea where that was. I really knew nothing of the jazz or the politics, and I learned that all while I was there.
What did the stories, I mean, what did they mean to you, or what impression did they give you about Kansas City?
The first impression was it was a lot more, what should I say, a vital jazz hub, and then also a very seemingly corrupt place at that time. Pendergast had built that Brush Creek with cement because he was way into cement.
Yeah, that's kind of, I guess, on some level, a running dark joke here in town.
Yes.
Were you surprised what the crucial locations for this, like, major history, the places where Kansas City jazz was born, the place where Union Station, where so much of the sort of political story of Kansas City coalesces. Were you surprised by what they looked like and the shape they were in when you arrived here?
When we got to Union Station and we learned that that was one of the major locations, we actually built a lot of sets within Union Station as well that were used. It was almost used as a sound stage at times. But the building, we had to wear hard hats. As Chuck said, there were puddles everywhere. You didn't even know that there was beautiful marble floors inlaid.
What did you see instead?
Dirt and a whole lot of the ceiling was falling down. They had to put stuff up to hold it in place while they were renovating for the film. There was plaster, tons of dust. So it looked like a demolition site. And it was surprising how much the crew did. They were polishing floors. They were polishing the marble. The basement, the sub-basement, as they called it, was full of furniture. And it was as if people had just walked away from their offices at some point. There was a very strange, thick, white mold over everything down there. But we actually borrowed a lot of set dressing from down there because it was so handy and period.
You know, the 18th and Vine area, as Chuck has mentioned, also had to be visually transformed in some ways to work as a set for a movie where this is a vibrant place. Can you take me back to the 18th and Vine that you encountered and what it was about it that had to be transformed?
What we saw were just facades of brick, and I think they were mainly brick, and there were no buildings behind the facades. I don't know how they ended up standing like that, but they were supported with beams of some sort. They would build like a entrance back way so somebody could enter a building and it looked as if they were entering a jazz club. But then we decorated all the shop fronts as if they were vibrant stores or jazz places.
How did you do that?
Basically, they built, there were kind of windows there. So they built like window boxes, and we would make different shops displaying things in the windows. And they had a lot of signage and a lot of lit signs. So it looked very dynamic at night, especially.
And night is when a lot of this takes place.
Right.
What do you think that the shape this stuff was in might say about how we viewed our history back then? I mean, you were in Kansas City for a while, right?
Right.
And so I'm guessing that you met people, talked to people, told them what you were doing, and heard a little bit about how locals responded to that.
Yeah, I think everybody was excited about Altman making a movie. And then if you said anything about corruption, they would be like, well, I don't know. That's probably not something to focus on. But I didn't get the feeling that I didn't even know at the time that 18th and Vine had been a big hub. To me, it was like, oh, they chose this location because it happened to be so decrepit that they could do anything they wanted with it, or we could do anything we wanted. So it was only during the process of renovating it that they found out, oh, this actually was a huge hub of jazz.
You know, as someone who I'm guessing does this kind of film project a lot, I mean, have you made other movies based on historic places, set in historic places? How does this compare?
I've done period movies, but not necessarily focusing on a historic element of the cities. So I think this one felt the most incorporating realistic events and realistic aspects of the city.
Chuck Haddix, I want you to chime in here. I mean, when you hear that someone who was physically on 18th and Vine coming in from the outside didn't realize for quite a while that this was really the birthplace of Kansas City jazz.
Well, you know, I think that the movie raised our consciousness about our history. And Kansas City is like an elderly lady of former ill repute who just do not talk about her past. And 18th and Vine had fallen into disrepair, Union Station the same. And I think both areas were renovated because of, out of shame, because this, I mean, this is all over the Kansas City Star.
So we were shamed by the project into taking these places seriously?
I think so. I mean, there was talk about, in those days, talk about tearing down Union Station. And then when people saw what it could be, it changed things. And, you know, I mean, you know, let's face it, we're today we learned that there's a film about Kansas City being made in Atlanta.
Yeah.
And earlier on, I was listening to KCO on the way in. And this was a big deal because it was a film about Kansas City made in Kansas City. And not only did it give the city a boost financially in our pride, but also provided work for people as characters in it. And it really raised the consciousness of people about Kansas City jazz and the role it played. Originally, I was contacted by Frank Barheit, and then I worked with Matthew Sieg, who was overseeing the music. And originally, Johnny Mandel was going to do the music. And I talked to him, and he was going to authentically recreate the music of the 1920s and the 1930s Kansas City jazz style. The event, the legendary cutting contest, happened December 18th, 1933.
Okay, the legendary cutting contest.
And that's the center of that's the thread that runs through the film.
Yeah, explain it.
Well, the legendary cutting contest in December 18th, 1933, Fletcher Henderson came to town, and Coleman Hawkins was a member of the Fletcher Henderson Band, and they played at the Roseland Ballroom. And they had kind of a light draw, really, about 500 people, because Cab Calloway had recently been through. They were staying at the Booker T Hotel, which was right across the street from the Cherry Blossom, which was located in what was known as the Eblon Theater originally. And Count Basie was hosting an all-night jam session at the Cherry Blossom. And Coleman Hawkins and other members of Fletcher Henderson stopped by because they got off early. And Lester Young and Ben Webster challenged, another saxophonist challenged Coleman Hawkins to a duel. a saxophone jam session, a duel during a jam session. They would go in and out of key, and it's
cutting contests are fun.
Cutting contests, yeah, and it looms large in Kansas City legend because Mary Lou Williams recalled it, and so did Jean Ramey, and they talk about how all night Coleman Hawkins was the reigning king of the tenor saxophone. Lester Young was relatively unknown outside of Kansas City. And Hawk had everything to lose, nothing to gain by jamming. That night, he decided to go get his horn, and he was going to show these Kansas City cats a thing or two, only he found they had very sharp claws. And Coleman Hawkins and Lester Young engaged in a battle that lasted all night long. And they wore out piano players. Ben Webster went to get Mary Lou Williams at 3 o'clock in the morning. And the battle was raging on. They just worn out all the piano players. Basie himself did not participate because he couldn't transpose keys on the piano. He wasn't a very accomplished piano. And Mary Lou Williams recalled that they jammed until noon the next day. And then that time, Lester Young defeated Coleman Hawkins in his cutting contest. And Coleman Hawkins burned up his new Cadillac trying to get to St. Louis for the next gig with the Fletcher Henderson Band. And it becomes a metaphor for the ascendancy of Kansas City jazz.
And the idea of an us versus them kind of piece of it, too.
Correct. Correct. And there was quite a bit of debate. Johnny Mandel dropped out early. And so they brought in Hal Wilner, the record producer, and he's done work with a legendary record producer, worked with Lou Reed and put together these compilations and also worked for Saturday Night Live. And he had a very different version than Mandel. And these young musicians that were coming to town, I mean, they had this all-star date, Craig Handy, James Carter, Joshua Redman, David Murray, Jerry Allen played Mary Lou Williams, Don Byron, David Fathead Newman, Ron Carter, Nicholas Payton. That's just a few of them. And these musicians didn't really know how to play Kansas City style. So what Hal and Altman encouraged them to jam. And so they would get together at the Mardi Gras Club right up the street from where the cutting contest happened. And they jammed.
And this is in the 1990s.
Yeah.
And this is, so, okay, there is something that you said earlier that Kansas City is like an elderly lady of ill repute who just as soon not talk about her past.
Right.
I don't know if I feel that Kansas City is like that now, but I definitely feel like Kansas City was like that then. Now, I feel like we're very proud of our past, even the seediness of our past, like maybe kind of weirdly so. You know what I mean?
I would disagree with you. Not like New Orleans or New York or Chicago. They revel in their notorious past. We talk about, you know, oh, Paris of the Plains, you know, and all that. But we don't celebrate our past like we should. I don't feel anyway.
Well, so do you think that the movie changed anything in that respect?
Yes, I do. I think it raised our consciousness about our history, about the Pendergast machine, and about corruption, violence, jazz. It's all there.
Well, we are talking about Robert Altman's Kansas City, which came out in 1996. There's a screening this weekend, and we're taking the opportunity to look back on what the movie meant to us then and how we see it now. Call 816-235-2888 with your stories about the making of the movie and the legacy it left behind. 816-235-2888. This is KCUR's Central Standard. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about Robert Altman's Kansas City. They're screening the movie at the Screenland Medallion Theater at Plex Pod on 39th Street this Sunday, and Bobby Altman, Robert's son, will be there. My guests looking back on the making of that movie are Chuck Haddix and Susan M. Schwiller. Chuck was a consultant on the film, and Susan worked on the set. Chuck, you were talking just a little bit ago about that this movie gave people in Kansas City in the 1990s work.
Oh, yeah, of course. You know, anytime you have it was a big production. They filmed the scene from the Hey Hey Club at the old Myron Green cafeteria. And that had to be redone. And there were a lot of people at Union Station walking. A lot of actors got work. And that spilled over into the community, too.
And what about musicians?
Well, they didn't use local. They used the young cats from out of town. And I think that the film, there's a companion film to this, and it's called Kansas City 1934. And it's footage of the legendary jam session. And it tells the story. Harry Belafonte narrates it. And I think that's the film that Robert really wanted to make.
Interesting. Can you say more about that?
Well, it's an hour-long film, and he took a footage that he'd shot and created another film. And it focuses exclusively on 18th and Vine and on the legendary cutting contest, and tells the story of that. You know, he Altman and Barhite knew this territory well. They populated it with historical figures like Seldom Seen. Seldom Seen was a well-known gambler, and if you went into Gates Barbecue, there'd be Seldom at 19th and Vine. There's Seldom Seen would be there, and he'd have watches on his arm. And there was a gambling game underneath Homer Roberts Motors, and they refer to Homer Roberts Motors. They knew this territory very well. They did an excellent job of recreating the era too.
Well, Susan, you know, Chuck has referred to another location that had to be sort of revived and, you know, made to look vibrant for this movie. Mm-hmm. Can you talk? Was that part something you were involved in, a cafeteria?
Yeah, that was, if I remember, it was downtown. We called it the Hey Hey Club in the movie. And it was pretty much abandoned. And we brought in all the set decoration, the tables, the lights, everything that would make it period and kind of a juke joint feel to it, so that the musicians would feel really comfortable there.
Susan, I understand that you met your husband working on the set of this movie, that he was from Kansas City, and that you come back periodically. Are you surprised to see downtown and how it's changed?
Yeah, I was the first time I went back, I was so glad that they hadn't torn down Union Station, because we had been told when we were reviving it for the film that after we were done, they were going to tear it down. And then it was.
How did you feel about that? I mean, as someone who was in there cleaning up the puddles, scrubbing dirt off the floor, then hearing like they're going to tear this place down.
We were so hoping that if we did a good job, people would see that there was a lot here worth saving. And so it was so thrilling to find out that they were actually going to put in restaurants and the Science Museum and all the things that they've done to it. And the 18th and Vine, having a museum there, keeping the facades, really felt like we had done our part to help Kansas City see, wow, we've got some really great stuff here. We should keep it.
Well, Chuck, you know, you were involved as a music consultant, and I love the soundtrack for this movie. Do I have you to thank for that?
Actually, you have Hal Wilner to thank for it. And the unsung hero here was Stephen Bernstein. Stephen is a trumpet player, very well-known jazz musician. And they brought him in about midway through the production because the band wasn't gelling. And he came in and did the arrangements and picked the music. Hal Wilner, you know, with the problem with making an authentic sounding soundtrack was that there's very few recordings between 1932 and 1935 because of the Depression. These bands like George E. Lee and Benny Moten functioned as territorial bands. So when they would go up north, they would play accordions. And Hal was saying, all I'm hearing is accordions. And he wanted to bring in Fletcher Henderson tunes like Queer Notions and things like that. But it is the authentic sound of Kansas City. They did a great job on the soundtrack. It's kind of interesting because this really led to my writing a book on Kansas City. Frank Driggs was working for Columbia, and he put out the real Kansas City with the original recordings. And he made some mistakes in the liner notes, and I wrote him and told him that, you know, hey, this session was done at WDAF, you know, you made a few mistakes here. And so it led to me co-authoring a book with him, although he didn't write it, I wrote the whole thing.
Wow. You know, we've got a call. We don't have a lot of time for this, but I do want to talk to Lester, who has called us to say something about how we see our history. Lester, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Hi.
I was calling just to say that, you know, yes, Kansas City hasn't really embraced this history, maybe because, in my opinion, we were Vegas before Vegas. We were the gambling capital. We were the music capital. We were entertainment. We were you know, some of the other things that went along with that too, prostitution and some other things. But Kansas City has not really embraced that, all the way to the fact that even on 18th and Vine, between 18th and 19th, the sets that were, the buildings that were used for the sets are still, some of them were still there, and they haven't been remodeled or turned into anything. They're just still sitting there. And I was wondering why, and I know that zoning had a lot to do with it, because there's a church behind those buildings, so you couldn't sell liquor within a certain amount of feet or yards from a church. But I was wondering why, you know, we still haven't fully embraced the fact that this was the entertainment capital, in my opinion. And it now still hasn't really taken off more than just on 18th Street.
Lester, I'm going to let Chuck respond to that, and we're going to have to go in just a minute. But Chuck?
Actually, the city has been shoring up those buildings. Adam Jones and his crew have been securing the walls and making sure that they could be used for future projects. In fact, the fire down there would have been much worse, the fire about a few months ago, if Adam hadn't gone in and really restructured the inside of it and shored it up.
But it sounds like Lester is of the same opinion as you about how we see our history.
Oh, Kansas City was a wild place. You know, Paris of the Plains, prostitution down on 14th Street, number runners were as regular as postmen in the 18th and Vine area, and so many colorful people like Felix Payne, a great sporting man.
Well, Chuck Haddix, thank you so much for talking to me about the movie Kansas City, Robert Altman's Kansas City.
Glad to do it.
And Susan M. Schwiller, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And now, get ready to shred on the air guitar with a local air guitar champion. I'm here now with Beth Mellon, also known as Cindere Ella. That's the song that we just heard. That's the song she's practicing on the air guitar in preparation for tomorrow's air guitar championships at the Record Bar. Hi, Beth.
Hi there.
So last year you won second place in the National Air Guitar Championships in Washington, D.C.
I did.
How do you become an air guitar champion? For people, okay, I think most people know what air guitar is, but in case someone does not.
Okay, so, I mean, air guitar is what you think it is, but most people do it alone, maybe in their bedroom, possibly while driving in their car, only if you're safe, of course.
It's when you're holding
it is when you,
a non-existent
right, when
guitar.
You hear a song and you just can't help yourself and you feel like you need to play that guitar lick just like the guitarist did, so... That's what we do, but we do it in competitions, and it actually goes all the way up to Worlds in Finland.
So back to this question of how you become an air guitar champion.
Mm-hmm. how do you become one? Well, I mean, you have to compete in an official competition, and U.S. Air Guitar has bunches of competitions all over the country to lead up to finding the national champion. And we have really pockets and communities of air guitarists all around the country. We're very supportive of each other. We help each other out with song cuts and practicing and coming up with moves and all kinds of things. So,
do you play a non-air guitar?
I personally do not, but actually I'd say at least 50% of air guitarists are musicians of some sort.
So you put a lot of time into practicing the air guitar, but... It sounds, when you describe what you're doing, it sounds like learning to play an actual instrument. Why do you want to play an air guitar? and not a guitar.
So with air guitar, it's really about showmanship and being able to let out your inner rock star, right? So when I got into air guitar, I watched a competition and I thought I could do that and I could be on stage and people could cheer for me and that would be fantastic. So,
and you really, wouldn't have to worry about what it sounds like?
Exactly. I mean, there are three elements to air guitar that you are judged on. So one is technical merit. How much does it look like you're playing the air guitar? One is stage presence. Pretty standard. The other one is airness. And airness is sort of, you know, when you see it, that extra element when the performance goes beyond pretending to play guitar and becomes an art form in and of itself.
Can you give an example of a time when you achieved true airness and you knew it was happening and what it felt like?
Honestly, at Nationals last year when I got second place, we went into the second round. Second round, you just have a song thrown at you, so it's improv. And there were a few people who went ahead of me, so I got to listen to it a few times. But you just go up on stage.
What was the song?
I actually don't remember the song anymore. I didn't know the song when they played it, so I had to come up with all the moves on my own in just a few minutes. But I got up there and I just really embodied the character that I've created, Cinderella, and rocked my hardest, and the crowd went wild, and it was just amazing.
So tell me about this character, Cinderella.
So Cinderella is sort of this alter ego, and most air guitarists sort of create one. Mine is sort of a powerful, sassy, doesn't take any guff type of woman who really wants to be in charge of her own destiny.
Unlike Cinderella, who is not very much in charge of her own destiny.
Not at all, yes.
Okay. Backing up on this, you said that, and I think this is probably true, most people think of air guitar as something that people are doing, you know, in their bedrooms, unseen.
Sure.
Picking up that invisible guitar and just going for it.
Right.
How do you go from doing that to being part of a community of people who do that? Because it does seem like sort of a private indulgence.
Sure. I honestly, one of the first steps, go to an air guitar show. If you go to an air guitar competition, you will see other competitors, see what it's all about, but also, generally, they have a few spots and you could sign up on the spot just then. Try it out for yourself and see how it goes. And most people, I wouldn't say they become addicted, but they're pretty much hooked when they get up on stage and do it.
When you are performing a song that you don't know, as opposed to a song that you know, that seems like it would be really different, because that whole idea that it's just someone who is so moved by what they're hearing, and it's specifically the guitar line, to just like emulate what they imagine it's like to play that. That seems like a total fan thing. Like, this is my favorite song and I'm jumping up out of my bed. You know what I mean?
Definitely. Yeah. And so the first round song is a cut you make yourself. It's you generally that song you love. But that second round when they throw it at you, that's really when you have to go inside your character, make sure that you're making that character come out on stage, that you're reaching the audience, and that you're hitting sort of key points in that song. It's very important, you know, as they say, to stick your landing. So you got to hit the ending.
When you think back on your personal story as an air guitarist, can you think of, like, just as far back as you can go, the song that you first remember, even just in an amateur way, playing the air guitar to?
Well, you know, I grew up in the 80s. So basically all 80s hair metal is my jam. So when that stuff comes on, I'm definitely rocking out.
What does that mean that your greatest skill is as an air guitarist? Something that you learned from all that hair metal?
Honestly, be true to yourself, enjoy life, and share it with everyone.
Huh. I didn't expect it to be so philosophical. Well, the Air Guitar Championship is tomorrow night at the Record Bar starting at 8 p.m. Cinderella, good luck.
Thank you so much.
Cinderella is Beth Mellon. She won last year's local and regional competitions and went on to take second in the Nationals in Washington, D.C. That's all for today. You can grab today's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's where we keep all our past shows. If you missed yesterday's show, we talked about change in the Crossroads neighborhood as YJ's prepares to move from its iconic location. KCUR.org/Central Standard is where you'll find that discussion. And tomorrow, a vegetarian food show. Call in with your recommendations. This show is produced by Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Sylvia Maria Gross with help from intern Trevor Hook and help today from Anna Yukatenko. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.